to another episode of the American Revolution podcast. So last week we talked about the Sugar and Currency Acts that were put forward by British Parliament. Now, as we said, the Sugar Act reduced the importation taxes for foreign sugar to the British Isle. But what they would have to do is then turn around and up the export price of those finished materials to the American colonies. So the Sugar Act was a big problem. Coupled with the fact that now the Currency Act was put into place, where the American colonists would try and create their own currency system to alleviate this pressure because they don't have hard currency available to them, the British Parliament turns around and torpedoes that idea as well. So now the American colonies are at an impasse. They have to pay exorbitant prices for the sugar, molasses, and rum that they so very much love. And at the same time, their best bet for paying off these insane taxes has now been put down by the British Parliament because they don't like their monetary policy of using paper money. They want to use hard currency. Unfortunately, the American colonies don't have hard currency to work with. So the British Parliament puts forward a new tax, a stamp tax. Now, I know we said last week that we were going to talk about both the Stamp Act and the Quartering Act, but I've had to cut short the Quartering Act because there's just too much to talk about the Stamp Act, and I don't want to make this episode longer than it needs to be, so we're just going to stick with the Stamp Act this week and push the Quartering Act to next week. So this week is all about the Stamp Act. The Stamp Act, once again, just another feather in the cap of why the revolution was started. The act itself was a tax on officially stamped paper that was required for legal papers, periodicals, and other important documents. The act is passed on March 22, 1765, and it was to take effect November of that year. Now, the tax itself was talked about since 1764. And it was a talking point for colonial governments as to how they were going to implement this Stamp Act when it took effect. The biggest problem for the colonial governments was the fact that the Stamp Act itself couldn't be paid for with colonial currency. So the paper money system that we talked about last week was totally null and void when it came to the Stamp Act. The stamps themselves had to be paid for with British currency, hard currency, gold, silver, you know, so on and so forth. Materials that the American colonies had no access to. And with rising taxes on things like sugar, a lot of American merchants are hamstrung to try and come up with currency. Now they have to pay a tax on stamps. The problem with the Stamp Act wasn't the fact that it was thought to be implemented. It's when, on March 22nd, 1765, it's put into effect. The Stamp Act was being discussed by colonial governments, but when they're completely passed over and the Stamp Act is implemented, it sets off a firestorm across the American colonies. Some of our most famous lawyers will talk about the illegality of the Stamp Act because it was a prime example of taxation without representation. The American colonies had representation in British Parliament, but these individuals were not from the American colonies, nor had they ever really been there. So when the colonial government stand up and say, whoa, hold on, where your royal appointed servants and the governors of these American colonies, we should be the ones that are able to tax the populace. Not a tax handed down from British Parliament across the seas, but a tax that is implemented by this government for these colonies. in the major cities like New York, Boston, mobs will burn effigies of the stamp commissioners, the men who were supposed to collect money and distribute the stamps. In Boston, rioters looted the home of Andrew Oliver, the Stamp Act commissioner for the city. Many of these commissioners were so put off that they'll resign. When the rioters looted Oliver's home, the next day he resigned his commission and said, no, I really do not feel like being the commissioner, because if they're going to loot my home and I haven't even collected a cent for these stamps, just imagine what happens when I say, okay, here's the stamps, now start giving me money. That great Virginia orator, Patrick Henry, will stand up to the House of Burgess and say, Caesar had his Brutus, Charles I his Cromwell, may George III profit from their example. Now, some right-thinking individuals in the American colonies organized a stamp congress. And in October 1765, the Stamp Act Congress met in New York City. Now, when we talk about the Stamp Act Congress, we talk about it from two perspectives. One, we talk about it as a positive. For the first time, the colonies were joining together in common interests so that they can discuss their issues with the British Parliament in a way to resolve them in a political and democratic way. The opposite side to that coin is the fact that the Stamp Act itself was a complete and utter failure. First problem was only 9 of the 13 colonies would send delegates to the Congress in New York. Georgia, North Carolina, New Hampshire, and Virginia would all sit out. It's very surprising to see that Virginia and New Hampshire would be sitting out. North Carolina was very hesitant later in the war years to send any help whatsoever. And Georgia, well, they almost get excluded from every major committee meeting of Congresses and anything else that will happen during the war years. Georgia itself is held in control of the British crown by 1,000 loyalists. They didn't even have any British soldiers there, but the colony was so against leaving Britain that they just said, here's 1,000 men. We can hold the colony down. This will be a running theme of Georgia sitting out of major political events. The Congress, or the 9 colonies that actually show up, will put forth what is known as the Declaration of Rights. The Declaration of Rights is our first attempt to air out the grievances for the American colonies to King George III and say, here's a list of our problems. We would like to discuss them with you. Will you please view our grievances? And can we make some changes accordingly? Now, I'm going to read an excerpt from the Declaration of Rights. I'm going to read the first paragraph pretty much word for word, and then I'm going to read the 13 points that the Americans make, but I'm going to do it more abbreviated because it's very wordy, and I'm just going to hit exactly what the point that they're trying to make is, because I don't want people to get confused as to the understanding of what they're trying to say in each particular point. The members of this Congress sincerely devoted with the warmest sentiments of affection and duty to His Majesty's person and government, inviolably to the happy establishment of the Protestant secession, and with the minds deeply impressed by a sense of the present and impending misfortunes of the British colonies on this continent. Having considered as maturely as time would permit the circumstances of said colonies, esteem it to our indispensable duty to make the following declarations of our humble opinions respecting the most essential rights and liberties of the colonists and of the grievances under which they labor by reason of several late acts of Parliament. Number 1. His Majesty's subjects in the colony owe the same allegiance as those born on the isle. That basically means that the colonists owe the king their same allegiance as any subject would that is living on the British island. Number 2. Subjects in the colonies have the same inherent rights and liberties as natural citizens. The natural citizens are basically those that are born on the island of Britain. And what they're asking for is the same inherent rights and liberties. They are not any different just because they are born in the American colonies. They are the same British subjects that are born on the island of England. Number 3. No taxes should be levied on Englishmen without their consent. Well, that's pretty self-explanatory. No Englishman should have to pay a tax that they are not, you know, they have not voted for. And the previous 2 points have made it very clear that the colonists are just as much Englishmen as those Englishmen living in England. Number 4. The colonists cannot be represented in the House of Commons. They are a separate entity. They should have their own separate parliament that will run the colonies accordingly. They should set up the taxes for the colony. They should take care of the colony's issues. But what they are given is non-colonial representatives in the House of Commons, which is, in the colonist perspective, useless. Point number 5. I've kind of overshadowed point number 5 when my explanation of point number 4, but colonials should choose their representatives, and only they could tax the colonists. So I've already made that point. Number 6. The people of Britain cannot grant His Majesty the property of those of the colonists as a present. What has happened in years past is landowners that live in England, that hold lordship over some lands in the colonies, have then turned around and granted those lands to the king as a present, which in turn, the people who are living on that land working it are removed because it's now a royal government's land. Number 7, colonists have an inherent right for trial by jury. There's been a couple of instances in the past where the colonists, because they are, you know, colonists, they are viewed as less than Englishmen, have not gotten fair trials. Well, the colonies just want to reiterate the point that, yes, they are Englishmen, and yes, they deserve a trial by jury. Number 8, the recent acts of Parliament subvert the colonials' rights and liberties. They're once again reiterating the point that your acts, such as the Stamp Act, the Sugar Act, the Currency Act, have undercut the colonists' initial rights and liberties, the right to representation, to have their consent for taxation. Number 9, the payment of those acts are impractical. Well, we talked about it last week. The Currency Act was a monetary policy that they tried to implement to solve their lack of hard currency problem. So when the Currency Act comes into place and they can't use their paper money system, well, now you're passing acts on to us, like the Stamp Act, that we cannot pay for because you won't let us try and pay for anything. Number 10, profits from trade in the colonies are going to Great Britain, but not the colonies. If we're trading, why aren't we getting paid for it? That's a huge question for the colonists. We're doing all this trade. Why does all the money go to you? Why can't it come to us? We're the ones that are putting all the labor forth. We're the doing, you know, all the hard work, and yet you're getting paid for doing nothing. Number 11, the restrictions on trade will render them unable to buy British goods. Once again, goes back to the Currency Act problem. You won't let us use our money, and we can't use your money because we don't have any, and you keep taking our money because we're trading and you get the money. So all these restrictions is going to make it impossible for us to buy anything from you. So what's the point? The prosperity of the colonies, this is point 12, sorry. The prosperity of the colonies is dependent on the full and free enjoyment of their rights and liberties. So unless you can relax the policies that you're putting forward, Parliament, the British colonies cannot survive. Their prosperity was determined on their free and full enjoyments of all rights and liberties of Englishmen so that they can prosper on their own. And number 13, and this is kind of a weird point to put at the end, but it's kind of a point they're trying to make, that the colonists have a right to petition the king or parliament, which is basically the 13 points that I just laid out, exactly what this is. This is a petition to the king. So I always found that one kind of weird that they stuck that one on the end. Well, here's our 12 points that we have problems with. Oh, and number 13 is we have the right to say this to you because, you know, we want the right to say things to you. Now, though, in my opinion, the Declaration of Rights is a very well-crafted piece of legislature, it is completely useless. And I'll explain why. Well, number one was King George had no interest whatsoever in dealing with the American colonies. He thought that they, well, you know, you're our colonists, you're our subjects, you're just going to, you know, get in line, be put to heel. You pay what you're told to pay, and you don't complain about it. So it had no effect on changing the mind of the king. But a bigger problem was that when the Stamp Act comes into effect in November, there were no commissioners available to collect the taxes on the stamps. This had nothing to do with the Stamp Act. This had everything to do with the fact that every stamp commissioner resigned. Yes, they all resigned. So whereas the Stamp Act Congress was a first step in the right direction for the colonies to band together, talk politically, try and form a government system of their own, it's really the mobs that solve the problem because all the Stamp Act commissioners resigned. They're being burned in effigy. Their houses are being looted. They're being threatened on the streets. So while there's something to be said about their ability to work together and, you know, work politically, there's just something about the American attitude of we'll kick you in the teeth and then we'll ask questions later that it just kind of warms the heart. And it's definitely the turning point for the Stamp Act because they basically threatened every Stamp Act commissioner into submission. They said, we're not having this happen, and it will not happen. And they got their wish because on March 22nd, exactly 1 year later, 1766, the Stamp Act is repealed. Victory to the conquering heroes, that is, the colonists. Next week, we're going to continue on with our discussion of the Acts of Parliament as we move ever closer to the infamous, in my opinion, first shots of the Revolution, which is the Boston Massacre. Next week, we're going to pick up where we left off, and we're going to do the Quartering Act, followed immediately by the Townshend Act. So now I have recommendation for this week, and I'm going to stick with some of my media recommendations because, once again, there isn't a book devoted to the Stamp Act, at least that I've read. So this week I've chosen, simply put, The Revolution. It's a History Channel classic. It is a 13 documentary series that covered everything from the beginning of the American Revolution. It actually kind of starts just before the Boston Massacre and heads right to the inauguration of George Washington. Sound familiar? Well, it should, because it's kind of the timeline that I've based this podcast off of. I've watched it several times and used it as a great source for when I'm teaching a class on the American Revolution, and it's good for viewers of all ages. It's great. Now, I do have a counter-recommendation, something that is, to put plain, horribly done and should not be worth your time. And once again, going back to the History Channel, because for some reason they will put out great documentaries, and for every great documentaries, there's a big pile of horse manure. And that, my friends, is the Sons of Liberty. I am sorry. I have read reviews online, and people are pretty unanimous in my way of thinking, because I took it upon myself to try and watch it. And it's a three-part miniseries, and I barely got through half of the second episode. You never notice when you're just watching a slow train wreck, you're kind of like, it can only get better. It can only get better. It's just, no, it doesn't get better. History Channel did amazing with the revolution. I mean, everything was well done, well researched. The reenactors were phenomenal. Here, I really think that they had blind people in charge of picking actors. I mean, the guy who plays Paul Revere, I know him from other stuff, and he's a great actor. I love him. He's great. But he doesn't play a good Paul Revere. John Hancock looks like he's metrosexual. I don't understand that. I mean, he's so soft-spoken, so not John Hancock. I mean, John Hancock was a bit of a peacock, but geez, he was just terrible. And Samuel Adams looks like he should be on the cover of GQ. The real Samuel Adams was a 50-year-old brewer from Boston. He looked nothing like this 27-year-old guy that they had playing him in the show. So do yourself a favor. If you're looking at Barnes & Noble and you have two DVDs in front of you, and one of them is The Revolution, and one of them is Sons of Liberty, do yourself a favor, buy The Revolution, and throw the Sons of Liberty in the trash. So until next week, everyone remember, keep your powder dry. Have a good week.